the thing to accomplish nowadays. I have an awesome article that's about an awesome topic that Mr. Phoebe sent to me. It was it's about people who have been dying while they're waiting to get into treatment. This is authored in 2016, but it's much more relevant now anyway. Before we get into everything, though, I'm just gonna check in with my team and see how everybody's doing. What's going on, Mr. Lawrence? How are you?
Oh, I'm doing all right. It's been a stressful week, but
yeah,
it's almost over.
Yeah, we're getting to the best part of the week, our show. How about you over there, Phoebes? How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. I always feel better when we get on the show, so I'm in a good mood right now and taking everything one step at a time, trying to honor the mantra to slow down, trust the natural pace of things. That's
And
where I'm at.
recover together. That's what we're doing. It's a tough month for me. Yesterday was the 9th anniversary of the day my mother died, and Halloween will make 3 years since my father's suicide. But I'm trying not to let that hold me back in my recovery, even though I've been struggling with my mental health lately. I've been really depressed and struggling with all my anxiety and stuff. But either way, the only way we're ever going to get better is to deal with the things that we've got going on. So, to start the
I
show.
just say, in terms of the spirit of doing it together, thanks for sharing that. And I can say that those anniversaries are always hit hard. So just honoring where you're at emotionally, and glad you're with us, Lip. Much love.
Thank you. I very much appreciate that. Well, to get the show started, I'm going to read a little bit from this article that Beeb sent me. It's Opioid Addiction and Treatment Shortfalls in the United States. Every day in the United States, 78 people die from an opioid overdose. More than one person every 20 minutes. Since 1999, the number of overdose deaths involving opioids in America has quadrupled. That's multiplied by four. This country is in the midst of an epidemic, yet there is a devastating lack of capacity to treat those seeking help. Several recent studies have revealed that upwards of 80% of people in need of treatment are unable to access services, with many put on waiting lists for weeks or even months before there's the capacity to care for them. More than 30 million people live in counties that do not have a single provider of medication-assisted treatment like Suboxone or methadone. The vast majority of these are rural counties where mental and behavioral health professionals are also scarce, leaving people in many regions of the United States without options for treatment. And that was before COVID, believe it or not, quite a while before COVID. So now, in our current state, we're only letting more people slip through the cracks, and I've been personally presented with this problem. Sorry for the alliteration, but I've been trying to get into a program myself recently, and it's been tough, especially with mental health on top of everything. I've been told that I'm not crazy enough to get into specific psych wards, or that I have too many things that need to be addressed to get into a conventional treatment program. So I can definitely relate to all of this. And it's tough, people sitting around and just they're alone because of social distancing and everything that we have to do. And then on top of that, they feel even more alone because now when they're actually asking for help, they can't get the help that they need. So it's pretty difficult. And we're going to talk a lot more about this throughout the show. We're going to talk probably pretty in depth about it actually during Mr. Phoebe's segment. And Lawrence has his list as always. And before we get into anything too heavy, we're going to play a song by Halsey. It's called Nightmare, and it's pretty accurate in describing how I felt and how I still feel sometimes, fighting addiction. So we'll be back in about 4 minutes. Enjoy this song and we'll get the show started.
Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I shall die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take.
tasted blood and it is sweet. I've had the rug pulled beneath my feet. I've trusted lies and trusted men. Broke down and put myself back together again. Stared in a mirror and punched it to shatters. Collected the pieces and picked out a dagger. I've pinched my skin in between my two fingers and wished I could cut some parts off with some scissors. Come on, little lady, give us a smile. No, I ain't got nothing to smile about. I got no one to smile for. I waited a while for a moment to say I don't owe you. But I'm no sweet dream, but I'm a hell of a night. No, I won't smile, but I'll show you my teeth. And I'ma let you speak if you just let me breathe. I've been polite, but won't be caught dead. Letting a man tell me what I should do in my bed. Keep my exes in check in my basement. Cause kindness is weakness, or worse, you're complacent. Could play nice or I could be a bully. I'm tired and angry, but somebody should be. Come on, little lady, give us a smile. No, I ain't got nothing to smile about. I got no one to smile for. I waited a while for a moment to say I don't owe you.
Welcome back, everybody, to Recover Together. I'm Lip, your host, and last week, you guys might have thought we weren't here, but we were here. And we did our first ever recorded show, and it was in anticipation of me going to a program, so they have something to play while I'm not around. I've also been working a lot on my art lately. I have a lot of stuff that I've been drawing, and Mr. Phoebs over here, actually, I just sent him a picture that I drew over the weekend at my sister's house, and he appreciated the power behind it. What'd you think of that picture?
Yeah, it really moved me. And one of the ways I think of art as truly being art is like, you know, was the person trying to just mimic something, or were they moved to create something truly original? And like, it's just such a raw, I could tell you were just like flowing of emotion. And there's this way when I penciled, you know, it's a pencil sketching. And for anyone who does pencil sketching or etching, you know, there's a way in which trusting your mind and your hand without forcing your hand too hard is really important. You got to flow with it. And it's incredible what can come out. And you did that. And I like the depth of anguish, and also like there's, you know, it's kind of like three faces in the drawing, but the range of emotions shown in all those three faces, it's much more than that. And really, I thought showed just how complex the range of the emotional journey of recovery both within a person and between people and across people was like, just came through. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Nah. That's we'll exactly what
we'll
I drew it for.
Yeah.
Well said.
I was trying to convey the inner conflict that we have with ourselves while we're recovering, you know? And there's the three faces that are highlighted, but even if you look deeper in it, it's there's even more, and they all stem from the one face in the middle that is blurred out the most. So it's pretty cool, you know? And I appreciate you being able to see the true artistry that I put into it and recognize the fact that I was just a conduit and it pretty much drew itself, you know? What's going on, Lawrence? What do you have to say on the subject of art and recovery and all of that?
I think it's good that you're able to channel what you're feeling into words and images, not only for your own good, but for other people to see and experience and be moved by it. You know, I think that's the whole point of art. Like, if you're not moved by it, it's not.
Yeah, it's to connect, you know, to draw meaning from something, or to be able to get a glimpse of life through somebody else's eyes, or, you know, just to identify. You don't have to be the person who drew it to identify with it. And that shows with how Phoebes was explaining it. Like, it could mean something totally different to Phoebes than it did to me. Like, me and Lawrence were just talking out on the curb before the show about how that's like the true defining characteristic of art, is if somebody else, an outside person, can draw meaning from it. And it could be totally different from what I even originally intended for it to mean. But it goes into help, I guess, illustrate and define recovery, to be creative and to bring things to life and to talk about it with people. That's what we're here for, you know, to get people talking, to get people to understand, because treatment isn't really enough. And we see now, with me personally, how treatment's not even really an existing thing in my life. It's like they're trying to say they want to help you. And when I say they, I mean like the system, you know. They want to help you, but they don't want to put in any of the work. And people are dying, like this report says. People are out there overdosing, or they're too ashamed to ask for help, so they just don't. And it's a problem, you know?
There seems to have been a shift lately, you know, and it's not just you. It's been a lot of people that I work with. There's so long of a waiting list, and places are closing, and people are laying off staff. Now we have the vaccine mandates, and, you know, people are quitting. It's not the majority, but it's getting harder and harder, and, you know, providers are turning people away, and it's like, it's so frustrating, because you'll have somebody that has the willingness, you know, to enter into recovery or enter into treatment, and then there's all these barriers, and it's like, you know, it just screws people over.
Yeah, it becomes overwhelming, especially for the people going through it, and then for people like you who work with people that are going through it. I couldn't even imagine, like, especially if, what if something happens to one of the people that you're working with because they couldn't get into a program? The mental anguish and that whole aspect inside of the situation is another thing that isn't really talked about or brought into the limelight like it should be. We have, as addicts, we have a lot of people, professionals, who we form relationships with and stuff, and they also indirectly become affected by our inability to get treatment and everything. So it's a big hurdle that we need to get over, especially post-COVID. There's all this.
We're not even post-COVID yet.
Well,
we're still seeing the effects of it every day.
I mean, the mandate, like you said, is a big part of that, how that's going to impact. We already are in a staff shortage, kind of, in all industries, in some ways, nationally. So, but it's hitting any direct caregiving really hard, because either folks are, yeah, getting pushed out by the vax mandate, or folks are leaving because they don't feel safe working in, you know, fairly enough, like, you know, so it's, yeah, like, I agree. It's gonna, we're gonna keep moving in that direction of things being like less accessible. And, you know, all the way back in 2012, we were looking at, you know, an estimated 1.4 million people shortage in rehab treatment. So for across the country, and COVID's absolutely ramped a lot of that up. That's real. And increased the demand at the same time. And I think what's so frustrating for people is, like, we spend so much. You look at the numbers of how much money there is in theory being spent on, like, grants and tax dollars and different, like, settlements with the big pharma companies for treatment. It's sort of like, why is it still?
Exactly. It's a, where's so it all going?
But you kind of made a really good point, Lip, when you were saying how, like, it's not just the people in recovery who are suffering. It's also, like, the professionals who work with them, you know, like Clubhouse staff, for example, right? Like, you're already paying. We're paying somebody to kind of be there to provide support after, you know, or in between the need for more intensive treatment. And then when we know somebody needs it, we just spend out like waste out like somebody's getting paid to just spend hours and hours driving around pulling their hair out, you know. Yeah. And it's like we just need. And yeah, I'll start to probably get into the bigger picture, so I should stop.
Because all right.
There's a long history to this that I'm excited to talk about that goes all the way back to JFK, actually.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome. So. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and share the poem that I read last week on our recording just for the fact that it was such a powerful poem. And I also wrote one new one. It was kind of written in haste. I just wrote it on the curb outside while I was smoking before the show. But this one had a lot of thought put into it. It's called When. Why do I have to feel this way? Why does every blue sky always turn that darkest shade of gray? Everything worth anything never lasts too long. Even when I know I'm right, I'm almost always wrong. All I want is to just do better, a place to hide me from bad weather, a rope, a hand to grasp onto, a person whom is truly true. I don't know, but I'm done with this miserable, lonely, sad existence. So there's but one choice. My voice must be used to advocate against being abused or neglected like I've been recently, forced to live so indecently, afraid to speak, to ask for help with nowhere left to turn. What else? Relying on this medicine, I'm dead within and deadening, nerve ending, sending never-ending signals to my brain. And when you swear that I'll feel better, all I'm asking you is when. And that was When. That poem was really meaningful, actually, to me as I was writing it. And I hope that I was able to convey it with my words and to paint the picture I was trying to paint. I don't enjoy being an addict for the social reasons and the mental aspect of the whole thing, and I don't think that many people do. And if somebody's telling you that they do enjoy it, it's because they're not at the lowest point that they're going to be at yet, or maybe they're just successful addicts. I'm not sure, but I know how I feel about it.
They haven't had the consequences that some of us have had, whether it's physical, mental, you know, problems with the legal system.
Everything.
Some people have just been able to find a system that works for them that sort of keeps them insulated from some of those things.
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel like on a long enough timeline, that runs out. Your luck
for
runs
everybody,
out,
yeah, you know? just about.
But then you have the door and the opportunity to become the person who still has addiction because it lives with you pretty much most of your life, but are in recovery in a real way. And so they also are still okay with the fact that they are an addict, but they're managing their lives the way they want to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I was talking about was really like active addiction.
Actively in. Yeah. Heard.
But I'm trying to get to that point where that you were just talking about right now in my life. You know, I want to be able to help people. This is the career path that I don't even want to say that I've chosen, because it's kind of like it was chosen for me. Like, this is what I'm supposed to do. If anybody asks me what I do or what my career is, I'm pretty much like, in of the view that I'm an advocate. I am a activist, a social activist trying to reform the modern view of recovery and how we go about achieving that, you know. But Lawrence, when you try to get somebody into recovery, like, what are some of the professional, like, walls you run into, so to speak, like, being turned away or just there not being a bed? Like, is it as hard for you as it is for somebody trying to go about it alone?
I feel like even with my help, it's really hard. I mean, you saw, like, yesterday, it's like calling people, showing up at their doorstep, and trying to hold people accountable to do what they said they were going to do. You know, I've had recently had a lot of trouble with, okay, I want to refer somebody to some place, and I know it would be the best fit for them. And then they turn around and they refer the person to somewhere else that's not, I know is not going to be good for them. And there's that frustration. And I don't know if it's like because they're at capacity. I mean, I'll talk about this more on my list, but, you know, some providers are at capacity. And rather than to say we're too busy to help this person, they just like pawn them off.
Try to brush them off, yeah. So it's like it adds any, it's an even, in a way, it's even harder to deal with.
Or they'll say, go to the hospital.
Yeah.
Call Greener Pathways.
You know? Exactly. And then ultimately just get referred back to you by right. from one of your professional friends. And that's tough, you know, as an addict, like the strength it takes to even become public with your disease and ask for help is like multiplied by 1,000 when you throw in the fact that we ask for help and now it's we can't get it. Like, I am personally a struggling to recover addict, and I've been trying to get into a program for almost 3 weeks now, and it's like my outpatient clinic has called several places. The clubhouse staff has been helping me. If it wasn't for you, I probably would have never gotten my medicine yesterday. And it was like what you said, we had to like force the person who was helping me's hand. We had to go to their place of employment and pretty much have them call the doctor. And we still didn't even get it yesterday. We didn't even get it until this morning. So,
yeah, to me, maybe it's my perspective, but to me, it's more of an emergency. And the fact that other people don't view it as an emergency is upsetting to me, you know?
Yeah, and then they go in and throw on top of it, you could say that your mental health is a factor in it, but is it really a factor, or are you just trying to avoid doing the work, which is incredibly insulting.
Yeah, there's a lot of judgment. You know, I was happy the progress that was being made over the last few years, a lot of opportunities opening up, and everybody was on board and helpful, and lately there's just been a shift. There's been a lot of judgment of like, oh, well, why do you want to come here? You know, why are you out of your medication already? You know,
because
a lot of different factors.
You only gave me enough for a couple weeks. That's why. And then told me to find someone new. Alrighty. Well, it's about that time. We're going to take another quick break. And when I come back, I'm going to read a little bit more of this article. And then Mr. Lawrence is going to present to you his lovely list. And we'll talk even more. This is Recover Together, and I am Lip. Welcome back to Recover Together. You've got Lip here, and that was We're In This Together by Nine Inch Nails. I'm going to go back to that article that Phoebes had sent me, and it's a bunch of statistics. Percent of people who didn't receive substance abuse substance use treatment among those who needed it in California in the year of 2008. To 2010, those 2 years, about 91.8% of the people who were using and trying to get into programs couldn't. And that's an insanely high amount. In New York, it was 87.5% of people. And that's just ridiculous. And it's unnecessary. You know, we should be able to get the help we need.
It's probably way worse now.
Yeah, absolutely. That was before COVID was even invented. A nationwide deficit in capacity and access. The Center for Behavioral Health Statistics and Quality at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration reported that each year approximately 90% of the people who need substance use disorder treatment do not receive it. A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association earlier this year, 2016, echoed those results, finding that close to 80% of those with opioid use disorder are not getting the care they need. the percentage of those receiving treatment has risen slightly from 16.6% in 2004 to 21.5% in 2009. While this shows a slow growth in access, it also reveals a persistent gap in care. That is, those are some crazy numbers and some crazy statistics. 90% of people that are using and are actually, this is just people asking for help. It's not considering the people who are actively using and not asking for help. These are the people who are saying they need it and going out and looking for it. 90% of them are unable to get it. And that is just, that's crazy. That is hard to even think about.
Yeah, there's no justice in that at all.
It's like 90% of people being diagnosed with cancer not being able to get their chemo. It's crazy, and it's killing people. And people, oh, Phoebes, you're turned way down.
Oh.
There you go. Sorry.
The better? No, that's all right. That's all right. I was going to say, the other piece to it is, even if you get in, then you have the cost to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, I wonder how many of the people not getting that treatment, like, called, there was an opening, but they were like, I can't pay $6,000 or $20,000 right. grand for a 30-day program. Like, I was looking at a study that showed outpatient detoxes, mm-hmm. like, costs an average of $1,000 to $1,500. Inpatient rehab 30-day ranges from $12,000 to $60,000, right? It's like out of pocket. 3-month programs, you know, that are outpatient can still cost like $10,000. That's for outpatients. So, and then, you know, your ongoing medicated assistant treatment can cost about $5,000 a year. So that's the average if you're even accessing treatment. And it wasn't even until 2008 that addiction treatment could be covered by Medicaid.
Wow. So, I didn't know that. That's crazy.
A lot. Some things, but not at the same. The problem. Well, I can pause. I'll get into this too. But the long and short of it is there was an equity issue. So basically, what you would get paid if you were getting chemo on Medicaid, let's say that's 100%. You know, if it was addiction treatment, Medicaid would pay about like 40% of it, right? So there was a disincentive to even provide that treatment because you're like, I don't get as much money for it.
Right.
And that's what drives. At the end of the day, it's all about money, y'all. That's what drives
it's when, the bureaucracy. Like, where they're beds. That's so. Why I'm. That's what my whole activism is about. Eliminating the bureaucracy of recovery because it's not right, especially with this pandemic. I'm reading another article and it's in part about why addiction soared during the pandemic, and the number one thing is more people began drinking more heavily. I don't know if this is super public knowledge, but there was a huge alcohol shortage in like the first 3 months of the whole pandemic when the quarantining was enforced and social distancing, people started drinking a lot and addicts started using a lot more. But I mean, the good thing is there was a lot more acceptance of the whole mental health thing behind it. Especially within like the entertainment industry, a lot of actresses and singers and stuff started coming to the forefront and saying that they struggle with mental health. So it's not all bad, but I mean, you know, there's a lot of damage that was done by COVID, and it's not just there being a lack of Lysol at the store. Drug overdose deaths hit record levels in 2020. Preliminary data from 2020 indicates that the number of drug overdose deaths may have increased by 23% from 2019. If so, that would be the biggest year-to-year increase in fatal overdoses in the last 20 years. And that is reversing all of the signs from 2018 to 2019, in which all the overdose deaths and fatal overdoses were going down after the whole big fentanyl problem.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, too, that I heard recently the first half of this year, or like up to August, was double what it was last year, too.
That's insane. It really is. And there's just all these people that are dying because of this. And when you think about it, the ones that are asking for help aren't being like secluded from that. They're also dying because there's nowhere to get the help that they want from. They're relying on people like Lawrence here, recovery coaches, and the good graces of places like the clubhouse, allowing me to come and have a source to vent. It's made a big difference in my life, but not everybody has things like this available to them. And
or they don't know it's available.
Exactly. Yeah. Or they have no idea that it even exists, which kind of is a good segue, I guess, to Lawrence's list today. He was tasked with coming up with a list of barriers to recovery. So let's see what he has on his agenda for us.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's Lawless Lawrence here, and this is my barriers to recovery or treatment.
His lovely list.
The first one I wrote down is willingness. Some people might not be ready. You know, we talked about the stages of change. You know, it's pre-contemplation, contemplation, determination, action, relapse, and maintenance. And anybody can move from any of those at any time to another phase. But, you know, normally we suggest people, you know, try to enter treatment during the action phase, like when they're absolutely ready to go. But now with all these barriers and delays, we're trying to move people from a stage where they're not ready yet. And hopefully by the time they get a bed, you know, their willingness catches up. So you really have to, you know, discuss it with people, really be honest with yourself and see if you're ready to make a plan to move forward and expect, you know, that there's going to be some delays. If you're not ready, you could also practice harm reduction techniques, you know, fentanyl test strips, get Narcan, learn how to use it for you and your friends, seek out a syringe exchange like Next Distro or Project Save Point. Try to get people involved to help you remove the barriers. You know, like ask yourself, like, what would it take for me to be ready? And, you know, what can I do to remove those barriers that are in my way? Another big one is insurance. You need to have active insurance. If you have Medicare, it's really hard to get into treatment. If you have straight Medicaid, it's really difficult. So the solutions for that would be, you know, a local resource for that is the Healthcare Consortium. They have insurance navigators that can help you get set up with insurance pretty quickly. Or if you don't live around here, if you're from somewhere else, just type in insurance navigators. Another option for you is to go to DSS. A lot of times DSS doesn't do the insurance piece anymore unless you're already sort of in their system, like if you're getting disability or something. Most people go through the online marketplace that's been around for the last few years. And one of your other options is to go to a state-run facility. You know, there's McPike up north. And
my counselor was actually just talking about how that's his last line, going to a state-run facility or sending someone there. I'm not sure why. I just wanted to bring that up while you were talking about McPike, because that was specifically where he was talking about me going if I couldn't get into somewhere else.
Yeah, it's always kind of like my last resort too. You know, but they are out there. If you have, it's best to call providers and see what insurance they accept. Sometimes if you have the wrong managed care plan, they don't accept it.
Yep.
You could switch. There's a whole process for that. It has to be done by the 15th of the month in order to be in effect for the next month. So, you know, another 2-week gap there. One of the other barriers that I came up with is codependency. A lot of times I meet people that are involved with a partner and that partner is addicted also. And like they have to both do it together. And that's a problem for the treatment places because they don't want to accept couples So kind of a workaround for that is to try to stagger your entrance into treatment. Either call at different times, or one person will go in and maybe a couple hours later the other person will go in. Don't alert any kind of the staff, whether it's a hospital or rehab, that you're there together with a person, because they will kick somebody out, yeah, unfortunately. Or I've seen at detoxes where people show up together and they'll say, well, I'll take the female, but the male has to do outpatient. No. So you have to go home.
Hmm.
And then that ends up leaving.
Absolutely. The other person, I can see.
We'll just leave treatment, you know, so that doesn't really help anybody.
I could definitely see why that would stop people from wanting to go.
Right.
Splitting them up or.
Yeah. And there's starting to be discussion in the community about this, about like how can we keep people together.
There could be like relationship centered treatment facilities. That could be something that could be looked into in the future too.
Yeah, absolutely. Medication can be a barrier. Some places are unwilling to continue certain meds for people. We've seen that before.
Yeah.
Where you try to get them in the place and they say, well, you're on this stimulant or you're on this sedative, and we don't do that here. We're not going to take you. Some places you have to have documentation of those medications and they will continue them. But then you have to go through the whole process of like getting in touch with your doctor and getting the documentation. So it's best to try to get that ahead of time if you're preparing to maybe enter treatment soon. And sometimes you have to bring your own 30-day supply. So you may want to track it in a way where, you know, you get your script and then you're ready to go.
Hmm.
So another solution would be to call ahead and ask the provider about what they are willing to do or not willing to do and what documentation you need. Another barrier is employment or other obligations. If you have a human resources department, it's best to speak to them. Make sure that your job is going to be secure. Sometimes you have other obligations, like you have to do this once a month or you have to do this once
a
week.
Or you have children or stuff like that. And that is a big excuse for people not to go sometimes.
Right, so you want to talk to your family and friends and say, hey, this is something that I need to do right now. Like, can you help?
Exactly.
You know, I recently helped somebody get into treatment where their family tried to come to them at the last minute and say, oh, well, you know, their daughter said, well, I'm pregnant. And this person said, well, I need this, I need that. And they had to set a boundary and say, hey, this may be true or not true, but like, really, if you want me to be there for you, like, I have to go and do this now. And, like, you know, I kind of have to be selfish for a moment and take care of myself before I can come back and take care of you. If you have pets, some people have pets, and they're like, hey, I can't just leave my dog behind without food.
Yeah.
You know? So, again, asking family or friends, maybe calling your local animal shelter, and say, hey, this is my situation. Like, can you help me for 28 days? At his last resort, you have to be willing to give up some things. Sometimes you have to make hard choices in order to start a new life. Another barrier we talked about is COVID restrictions. Places may be closed. I don't know if they still are right now, but I know Conifer Park was not taking anybody new because they had a big COVID outbreak.
Oh, I didn't know that. I tried to go there recently, actually.
That's probably why you...
No, it was the medication thing that you were talking about.
Yeah, I had another guy the same. He was on similar medications to you, and they had turned him away. Lack of beds due to staffing, COVID restrictions. You know, they can't run at full capacity. Another barrier might be you need a COVID test to enter. So you have to get somebody to take you to the place that will do it and wait for the results or whatever. So, you know, again, we're
it's a lot.
Creating another barrier for somebody.
That really is a lot.
May just force somebody to be like, oh, you know what, this is too much. I just give up. So solutions to this is call every place and see how long the waiting list is, or Winnipeg will open up.
Just expand your support network as much as possible, pretty much. Get as many people involved as you can, you know. Like right. What I've been doing with you guys, calling you to help me with my meds, and Bob and Twin Counties and Crystal and everybody.
Right, so you might be in that situation where you're not going to find a bed, or it's going to be several weeks or a month before you find a bed. So what can you do in the meantime to keep yourself safe and sane? You
know? Reach out. And we're running short on time. And it's I actually want to bring somebody on the air if that's cool with everybody.
Sure. Sounds good to me.
Hi, Justine.
Hi.
How are you? What are you doing?
Nothing. What are you doing?
Nothing. I just wanted to let you know that you're live on the air at Recover Together, and we wanted to ask you a couple questions.
I knew you were going to do this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can't get you in the station. So what exactly is it like having somebody so close to you struggle with addiction?
What's it like?
Yeah, like seeing somebody like deteriorate and wanting them to do better and stuff. Is it hard to deal with?
Yes, very.
Why?
What do you mean, why? It is. It's just very hard. It's tiring. It's sad.
Well, the topic of today's show is barriers to recovery, and right now it's hard to get into programs and stuff, and seeing someone that's close to you, like I said, want so badly to do better and not be able to, how does that make you, like, feel about the recovery industry?
I mean, there should be more things available for people to get help that they need if they want it.
And there's just not right now. And that's what's so hard to deal with. And then on top of everything, you see me struggling with my mental health. And it's things like this radio show and stuff that help me get out of bed in the morning, you know, but not everybody has this available to them. So I just wanted to bring you on the air because I wanted you to be more involved with the show, and I wanted everybody to hear from you, and so they could see the reality of what this show really stands for. All right, well, you said your phone's dying, and
I didn't hear you.
You said your phone was dying, so I don't want to keep you on the air, but this was just a way to prepare you for
what the...
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
We were just preparing you for the future. We're going to bring you on again at some point. I just wanted you to experience a little bit of Recover Together.
Okay.
All right, well, I love you. And I'll talk to you soon, Justine.
Love you too.
Bye. All right, everybody. That was a surprise call to my sister, Justine. I just wanted to, I guess, bother her a little bit. We're running pretty late today. It is 2:49, and we still have to do the bigger picture. So without any more delay, we're going to play Phoebs' song, Nobody, by Nas, and then when we get back, we're going to paint a bigger picture for you.
One city, one country, one state. One state. Some place to be nobody. Some place to be. Some place you wouldn't know, probably. Yeah. Yeah. If Chappelle moved to God.
Ghana, the finest piece that I'm rolling. Where the service always roaming, I'm packing my bags and going. It's a challenging act, it's a balancing act. Visit beautiful places, it's more out here than the trap. Houses in Long Island, they always found them. House in the South, barely got out, sunny LA. Remember calls with Dr. Dre, he told me, don't let the palm trees fool you, be safe. Me and my higher self, we often would speak. Somehow we lost the connection, might meet a Joshua tree. And it's been bothering me, too many wavy women. Gotta log out of IG, can't be my ADMing. No kidding, it's hard to move like a civilian. I write the truth cause I live it, not like you musical. We did it big and they biggest. They rather shoot than write tickets. What it feel like to go get it? What it feel like to go miss it? In one city, one country, one state. Some place to be nobody. Some place to be. Some place you wouldn't know probably. Some place to be nobody. Bought a plane, said let's go to Paris. That's where baguettes are from, French bread that's long and narrow. I like the other definition, rectangular carrots. The concept of the song is rather esoteric. This girl said in Grenada we should go get married. Broke the meaning down of the Virgin Mary. And you got your own place. My favorite part of the night when you text me that you made it home safe. I'm contemplating at the home base how I'm used to breakfast in the ghetto sipping OJ. That's a picture right there, a moment in time. Before anybody wanted a photo of mine. Before the internet energy and social decline destroyed the vibe, fooling us with the headlines. Keeping us blind. Vultures eat you alive. Take heed to the signs. Wishing I find one city, one country, one state. Some place to be nobody. Some place to be. Some place you wouldn't know probably. Some place to be nobody. All my time has been focused on my freedom now. Why would I join them when I know that I can beat them now? They put their words on me and they can eat them now. That's probably why they keep on telling me I'm needed now. They tried to box me out while taking what they want from me. I spent too many years living too uncomfortably. Making room for people who didn't like the labor, but wanted the spoils, greedy, selfish behavior. Now let me give it to you balanced and with clarity. I don't need to turn myself into a parody. I don't do what you do for popularity. They clearly didn't understand when I said I get out, apparently. My awareness like Keanu in the Matrix. I'm saving souls and y'all complaining about my lateness. Now it's illegal for someone to walk in greatness. They want the same, but they don't take risks. Now the world will get to see its own reflection. And the anointed can pursue their own direction. And if you're wrong and you're too proud to hear correction, walk into the hole you dug yourself a projection. See me in my freedom, taking all my land back. They said a lot against me, thinking I just stand back. I got my legs beneath me, I got my hands back. A lot of people sabotaged, they couldn't stand that. I turned the other cheek, I took blow after blow. There's so much crisis in the world because you reap what you sow. When you keep what you know is meant for someone else, the ditch you dig for them, you might just end up in yourself. I'm in the secret place, I keep a sacred space. They keep showing their hands, but keep hiding their face. If I'm a messenger, you block me, then you block the message. So aggressive, the world you made is what you're left with. Pride and ego over love and truth is reckless. Y'all got a death wish, the stupid leaves me breathless. Some place to be. Yeah. Ain't ducking nothing. Just might have to build my own city where y'all need a real passport to enter. Miss Hill, we ain't going nowhere. They gonna have to deal with us. Make them uncomfortable.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Recovered Together. For everybody that was just listening, you heard my sister's surprise call that we made to her. Which reminds me, I am considering starting a new segment called Community Calls. I was just talking about it with Lawrence. We'll call the community or the community will call us. Right now, it's about time for Phoebes to paint the bigger picture. And before he does that, I'm going to read this poem that I just scribbled down real quick. It's called Help. The sun is shining and the sky is blue, but it's still I'm not sure what to do. I ask for help and start to beg, but no one seems to be listening. As I write or draw or paint these words, is it so absurd that I want to be heard? So I'll ask, and I'll ask again. Can someone please help me and all my friends? Alrighty, and here is the Titan Phoebes, and he has got a picture to paint.
Yeah, I'm gonna paint. I'm gonna paint a little history today for our bigger picture, because I think it's important for us to see the long view of how we got to this moment in time, and around a lack of the kind of intensive care that's needed for mental health, for recovery. And let's be real, I think the data shows about 80% of the time those disorders are co-occurring. So mental health and substance use, just they go hand in hand.
Well, I love history. I just want to throw that out there. It's my favorite
all right
subject.
Well, so back in like the 1700s and 1800s, there's this guy called William Tuke, who was a Quaker. He was an abolitionist of prison, slavery, all of it. And he was one of the most influential people in terms of shaping what mental health treatment should look like. And, you know, it was a model of retreat where nobody was restrained, where it was not a punishment model, where it was all focused about personalized, person-centered treatment that focused on social skills, self-control, and self-worth. So, like, we've had an idea of how to do this in this country for hundreds of years, but one of the things about it is it is expensive and it's labor-intensive. Anybody who works in this field knows you never have enough time to be as person-centered and as strength-based and as comprehensive and as long-term as you want to be to really help a person through a very complicated medical process of recovery, right? And so basically during the Industrial Revolution, because those times are really challenging, like a lot of change, a lot of physical injury, a lot of like people, like higher waves of immigrants who were leaving really traumatizing home situations, right? Mental health really started to expand in this country, and we never figured out how to provide that level of care, you know, on the scale that it seemed to be needed. And the focus on compassion kind of went out the window in favor of shame and stigma and lock away the problem, right? And
so
you had a huge burst of a punishment prison oriented model to institutionalizing people with mental health and addiction. Huh. And that was the 1900s, right? And basically through the 1950s and 60s, a bunch of activists started to, you know, through exposés and newspapers and other things, kind of reveal how wretched and non-healing these spaces were, that they were dehumanizing, people were dying, patients had no power over their own lives. And all of this kind of came to a head. There was that activist pressure. There was a increase in the number of drugs that were starting to help with some recovery in a way that people could actually, there was a shift of this idea that we had to just put a person away forever and tend them to, like, maybe we can actually treat them and they can go back to their lives. Like, that was starting to come with medicated assisted treatment, basically.
So that was like the elimination of asylums, like.
And yeah, exactly. And so, and there was kind of a need, but here's the problem. 1963, JFK, right? A lot of people love JFK for different reasons.
I think
reasons.
I know who that is.
He signs the Community Mental Health Act. It's a federal bill that is designed to create a community hub for mental health and what would eventually, I'm sure, have also held substance abuse, because that's kind of the trend that happened. Treatment in every single community in the country.
Wow.
And he proposed $330 million to build them and fund them.
And that's like $1 billion today.
Exactly, right? That's back then. And just like what happens for all the time, our senators and our representatives will pass these bills, but will not do the follow-up work to pass the bills to fund them. It happens with almost every reform that every activist celebrates. If anybody who's done activism long term will tell you, the heartbreak is watching that no one actually follows up with the funding to keep it going for the 5 to 10 years after it passes to make a difference. And it's devastating, literally causes death. That's what that report that Lip was reading, which was to the Senate Finance Committee. They wrote that to the people who would fund these programs, begging for them to fund them. And it never happened in 1963. Kennedy was assassinated 2 weeks later. And no one ever picked up the mantle and got it funded. So those very few of those places were built. And they would have been a hub where you could go and basically get outpatient or inpatient, or right, get connected to an advocate, somebody like Lawrence, right? Like, it's the model we're trying to build now, literally 60 years later, which is so frustrating. Fast forward to 2008, just to put this, like, we still have this problem in 2008. Again, our Congress, Republicans, Democrats, came together. They passed the bill called CARA, which was focused specifically on addiction recovery treatment, and similarly funding more expanded treatment. This is 2008. The bill passes. Is it 2008? I might have been even later than that, at least after 2008. The bill passes. The proposal that the Obama administration put forward was $930 million to fund what's actually needed for addiction treatment in this country. It never got a dollar funded. It ended up with $7 million got kind of snuck into like a different budget bill a couple of years later. That's it.
Wow.
And then
then we sit here and wonder why.
Why there's not enough facilities, right? Because nobody wants to invest in them. And the insurance is such a mess that it's, you know, basically, it's, here's the parallel I'll give to you. I just got dental insurance, right? If I call and ask for dental insurance, they're like, you're joking, right? Like, our listserv is 100 people long because everyone just got insurance to cover it. Insurance is one tiny step in the process, and it never does enough to actually get the amount of treatment that's needed. That's where we as taxpayers have to rally together and call our Congress people and say, like, actually, I want you to fund this treatment bill. Well,
That's what we're here for, you know.
I think we've gotten really polarized in our politics, this idea that the right never wants to spend money and the left only wants to spend money. And it's somewhere in the middle. And it's like, if we put this in perspective, we're talking about a tiny drop in the bucket of money compared to the trillions of dollars we spend on other priorities. I just want to make a call for
We'll be the new generation of activists who actually do follow up, all right?
Right. 5 to 10 years. Keep it funded. So that's my bigger picture for today.
Yeah, you know, I got involved in the activism in about 2013.
Yeah.
And I, you know, we've gone to these Stop the Overdose rallies and, you know, Overdose Awareness Day. And, like, the first year there was, like, thousands of people. And then the next year, there's like 500 people.
Yeah, and it just dwindles.
And then, you know, when you came to like this year, there's 30 or 40 people.
Right? There's
10
people.
We have to all do our part to make sure that we keep showing up to these, because, you know, if they're looking out of the governor's mansion, they see 30 people.
Nobody's going to get the help they need.
It's an unpopular thing, in their opinion.
Though, Phoebes, thank you for the bigger picture. Thank you, Lawrence, for your list. Thank you, Justine, for being an unwilling and unsuspecting guest speaker.
Poor Justine.
All righty. That was Recover Together. That's the end of our show, really, for this week. And just so everybody's aware, I am in the process of starting more social media attempts, TikTok, YouTube, all of that great stuff. So maybe we will be coming at you soon visually as well as audio-wickily, soundly. I don't know what the word is. All right, I'm going to play Can't Repeat by The Offspring, and that's going to close the show for us for today. And you guys remember to come back next week.
Peace.
See you there.
Later.
Bye.
that was Recover Together. Have a great week. We'll see you next week.